cutting the noise, mapping the moves, explaining what matters and what does not. Welcome to The War Room with Dr. David Katz, your weekly briefing on military strategy and the conflicts shaping our world.
Welcome to The War Room. I'm David Katz, and welcome to a freezing, dark, cold Johannesburg. I'm happy to say that we one day after the winter solstice, so I do believe the experts tell me that from here on out, it's just going to get better until summer descends. So I'm very, very happy about that. I do believe that on the other end of the world, it's the opposite situation. So enjoy your summers and your spring times, because you are going for longer and longer nights. We've been there, and I can tell you it ain't pleasant. I must admit, I have to say that I'm in a state of a bit of bewilderment. I'm a little bit disappointed about the state of affairs in the Middle East. And tonight I've asked Dr. Jacob Stoyle to join me to perhaps illuminate some of the concerns that I have, and ventilate some of the issues that need to be spoken about regarding what's happening, the latest. And he's certainly qualified to bring that to us, being research professor of Middle East security at the U.S. Army Strategic Studies Institute. He's chair of applied history at the Modern War Institute at West Point, and trustee of the U.S. Commission on Military History. Previously, he served as a senior fellow on the 40th Infantry Urban Warfare Center as an associate professor of military history at the U.S. Army School of Advanced Military Studies, better known as SAMS. He also co-founded the International Working Group on Subterranean Warfare and was awarded the Army Civilian Commendation Medal for his service to the United States Army. Dr. Stoyle, which is pretty relevant tonight, recently co-authored an article examining Iran's attempts to regulate shipping through the Strait of Hormuz and the wider implications for global strategy, maritime commerce, and freedom of navigation. Jacob, welcome to the War Room once again.
David, it's very good to be back. And I like that you began with winter is coming, essentially. We're sitting here sweltering in the summer, but winter is coming.
I can see by the way you dress, Jacob, that you can see the way I'm dressed. So, we're experiencing different things. But it's like I say, it's coming your way. That I can assure you. There are some facts in life that are not disputable. You know, the sun will rise and winter will come. Before we begin, Jacob, I just want to note that Dr. Stoyle is not speaking on behalf of the United States government, the U.S. Army, or any institution which he is affiliated to. The views, opinions, and analysis expressed are entirely his own and reflect his personal research and professional assessment. Before we start, Jacob, we had such a good history session the last time round. I'm not a great one for picking out dates and going back in history, but I think today is a pretty relevant date. And I would challenge, and most probably would win the bet, that let's say 9 out of 10 people, or maybe 99 out of 100, would not know the significance of the 22nd June. 1941 and 1944 occurred both on the same day. So let me illuminate what it was, and maybe we can enter into a bit of a discussion about it. 22nd June 1941 was Operation Barbarossa. That was the German invasion of the Soviet Union, where they advanced just before the gates of Moscow and were halted by the Soviet winter. There we go. There's winter again, the Soviet winter counter-offensive. The significance of all this, it was the largest invasion in military history, involving roughly 3 million Axis troops attacking along a front of nearly 3,000 kilometers. Absolutely, the enormity of it, absolutely stunning. And mostly in the West, forgotten in history. It's not something that we all know about. We are more concerned with D-Day on the 6th of June, which is minuscule. I'm not in any way denigrating what it was all about. It was one of the largest amphibious operations of all time, but certainly this dwarfed it, Operation Barbarossa. And at around about the same time, on the 22nd of June 1944, A few days after the D-Day landings was an operation launched by the Soviets, Operation Bagration, if I got the pronunciation correct. It took place from 22nd June to the 19th of August, and it resulted in one of the biggest defeats delivered on the German army in the destruction of Army Group Center, where hundreds and thousands of Germans were either killed, wounded, or taken prisoner in one of the Wehrmacht's greatest defeats of all time. Jacob, your comments?
Well, I think you're entirely right to highlight these very important dates. I mean, Operation Barbarossa, as you correctly identified, is this absolutely massive undertaking. I think there are a lot of interesting parallels and things to think about for the contemporary from it. So, for instance, the Germans achieved a very high level of surprise. The Soviet Union was not ready for it, arguably because the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact had been very successful for Germany. Germany was receiving a lot of material that it needed for the war effort. And so in some sense, from a strictly rationalist perspective, you can understand why the Soviets thought that Germany wouldn't want to upset that apple cart. But Germany is ideological. Mm. And at the heart of the German thinking in World War II is this war of annihilation against what they called the Judeo-Bolshevik conspiracy. And so from their mind, none of the other fights that they're having really matter until Barbarossa. Barbarossa is what the entire war is about, is going after the heartland, the Jewish heartland that's in Eastern Europe, where the Jewish population is and where the Bolsheviks are. And so this also makes them, it's not just the Soviets who are surprised, the Germans are also surprised because their entire campaign is based on a lot of faulty assumptions that are heavily ideologically based, heavily racially based in their thinking, that they have superior will and that will count for against their lack of logistics, their lack of mechanization, etc. And on Bagration, I really want to pick up on one of the themes we actually talked about, we kind of briefly mentioned last time, which is the globalized nature of the war by the time the Russians are launching their counteroffensive. And it's an absolutely critical counteroffensive, especially when twinned with the Normandy campaign going on in France. Together, each of them causes about a similar amount of German casualties, somewhere near 400,000, which Germany can't afford. But by timing them together, it means that Germany has no reserve to put in to stabilize one front or the other. From this point on, there is no stabilization of their fronts. And the other thing to think about is part of the Soviet success, and in Bagration, it's incredibly successful. They break Army Group Center, as you said, and if I want to say they advance some 300 miles, something like that. Yes. It's an incredibly rapid rate of advance, because there are now a highly mechanized army, and a large part of that is over 200,000 U.S.-built trucks that are carrying the Soviet infantry forward and artillery.
Yes, very much so. And against a Wehrmacht, which was not mechanized to a large extent, you're talking about foot soldiers and basically, stunningly enough, in 1944, a horse-drawn army. So you've got a highly mechanized Soviet army against quite an archaic German setup, certainly when it came to logistics, and certainly when it came to mechanization of the ordinary troops. And yes, all thanks to the United States for supplying the means of mechanization to a large extent. Where I think some balance, Jacob, has to be restored, and as I say, this is a combined effort between the Allies, including the Soviet Union, and all the Allies. It's a combined effort. We can't single out any one component of it and say, you know, these are the winners of the war, although modern-day Russia would like to believe that the Soviet Union was alone in this endeavor. But they certainly suffered the brunt of the German efforts, as you said, for ideological reasons. This was a pure ideological battle that in many, many ways didn't make sense, and the German army paid an enormous price for it. So yes, well put, and thank you for that. I just want to also highlight, and maybe you can illuminate us on it, I don't know if it's an area that you've examined, 500,000 Jews fought for the Soviet army. Some of them reaching the commanding heights of the Soviet command system. Want to tell us anything about that?
Yeah, I think it's an important thing to remember. Jews are represented in every army on the Allied side, in every major army, in an actually disproportionate way in most cases. It's something that's easily forgotten, and the Soviet Union was no exception, right? The Soviet Union is as close to as anybody comes to total mobilization. So the Jewish population is incredibly involved at all levels, just about, of the war effort, and plays heroic roles and important roles. And in Bagration, one of the early stages of it is actually begins with partisans attacking behind German lines in Belarus and Lithuania. And there are definitely Jewish partisans involved in that critical effort, which is part of the Russian deception campaign, and also helps sever German communications and logistics. And so there's a very, very important role. And I think one of the unfortunate legacies of the Cold War is that most people who are kind of casually looking at the history of the Second World War have the idea of the Soviet army being a Russian army, first and foremost.
Yep.
And secondly, it being this kind of unskilled, unthinking, just wave of man with this very racialized image of these kind of Eastern hordes overwhelming the German defenses. And that's not at all accurate. The Soviet army is incredibly multicultural. It's drawing from Central Asia. It's drawing from the Jewish community. It's drawing from the Caucasus. It's drawing really from throughout the Soviet Union. And by this point in the war, it's a very tactically and operationally adept army. And Stalin has loosened a lot of control because of the needs of the war, which is part of how the Jewish community is going to rise in the army. He's loosened some control of the army. Now, he's going to, at the end of the war, go a hard other way in terms of his anti-Semitism with the so-called doctor's plot reaction and all of this.
Yes.
But there's this brief moment where Jews are able to play a fairly significant role.
Yes, absolutely. Let's take, we'll continue a little bit with it after the ad break.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Welcome back to the War Room. I am in conversation with Dr. Jacob Stoyl. Jacob, you did mention, and which is 100% correct, and maybe it's not quite apparent to a lot of Jewish people, is that a lot of Jews fought in a lot of different armies, especially in the First World War. There were a lot of Jews that fought for the German army and fought in the German Air Force with great distinction. So Jews do find themselves on opposite sides of a conflict often. I think there's a bit of a legacy issue also with the Soviet Union sort of its contribution to the Second World War not being 100% popular in the West. And certainly the Jewish contribution to the Soviet war effort has been sort of lost to history in many instances. When we have a look at the Soviet doctrine of deep battle, if I'm not mistaken, and his name escapes me, but a lot of that intellectual thinking behind deep battle was formulated by a Jew. If I can't just remember his name, but that's...
Isserson.
Isserson, yes, exactly. There we go. So the Jews made an enormous, enormous contribution to the Soviet war effort, as other war efforts in the Second World War. I just wonder, just the last thing on this also, and going to my sort of the legacy of this and the treatment of Jewish veterans from the Soviet Union. Can we talk about a little bit about their treatment in Israel? My understanding is that... They were not at a certain stage. Soviet war veterans who used to come on with their full regalia and their uniforms on VE Day and that type of thing were not really that well received in Israel. Is there any truth to that?
I know during the early periods of the Russian Aliyah, there were definitely issues with that, but the World War II veterans, the Soviet War Veterans Organization in Israel, made great strides. And at Latrun, there is the beginning, and I suggest it for anyone going to visit, should go to certainly visit the Armored Corps Museum at Latrun, If you want, you can go visit the historic Latrun Monastery and the Latrun battlefields that are all there, and also a Second World War, the remains of a Second World War POW camp. There's lots of interesting things at Latrun, but in among the interesting things at Latrun, there is the beginnings of a museum to Jews who fought in armies around the world for the Second World War. And it does, while it's still in its kind of nascent, it does a very, very good job of highlighting the huge impact and the huge numbers of Jews who fought in under Soviet arms.
Yeah, that may have been, I don't know if the name's familiar with you, but I think it's been undertaken. I did meet him on one of the overseas conferences that I went to. I think it's undertaken by a Benny Michelson. I'm not sure if that name rings a bell with you.
Yeah, Benny Michelson is has done a lot of work in that area.
Yes.
He's a fantastic historian on actually quite a lot of areas, but it's been a project of his, among others.
Yes.
He's not the only person in this project. This has really been a group effort. I highly suggest, it's a short visit, but I highly, highly suggest a visit if you're stopping by Yad Lishiryon at Latrun, or if you're going for a hike near Latrun or seeing the Latrun battlefields and monasteries. Any of those reasons that bring you into the area, it's well worth a visit to stop by the, again, very nascent museum.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you, Jacob. I thoroughly enjoyed that little section of our talk. I don't know if I'm going to enjoy the next section, but before we begin, I want to again make that disclaimer that you, Dr. Stoyle, are not speaking on behalf of the United States government, the U.S. Army, or any institution which you are affiliated with. Your views, opinions, and analysis expressed are entirely your own and reflect your personal research and professional assessment. Okay, disclaimer having been done, give me your take from an Israeli point of view. Let's start with that. From an Israeli point of view, Jacob, how are they receiving, what are the implications of, just fill me in about this memorandum of understanding, the way you see it.
Yeah, I think there's been a lot coming out of Israel, and it's been pretty consistent. They view themselves quite hard done by, that essentially their feeling is that some form of defeat was snatched from the jaws of victory here, that the operations against Iran had been going quite well militarily. They had been starting to really bring win sets in. This was together with their operations against Hezbollah, the possibility of a more enduring Lebanon ceasefire, peace, disarmament plan for Hezbollah all looked to be on the horizon. Although that one had seemed to stall a bit, but it was still moving forward. And the memorandum of understanding, at least as most Israelis see it, kind of freezes all of that and really gives Iran, from what the Israelis are thinking, it gives Iran everything they've been looking for. So Iran, under the memorandum of understanding, doesn't have to get rid of its long-range ballistic missiles, or doesn't have to get rid of its ballistic missile program, though negotiations may change that, right? It's worth caveating that all of this is subject to the 60-day negotiations that have started in Switzerland. So Iran doesn't seem to have to get rid of its ballistic missiles. It doesn't seem to have to get rid of its proxies. Iran is claiming that it will have some sort of control over the Strait of Hormuz. And the Iranian government will get money that it badly needs in terms of relief. Now, the U.S. has, of course, said that, and the Memorandum of Understanding does indicate that this will all be in exchange for Iran ending its nuclear ambitions. But from the Israeli perspective, this leaves all of the threat of Iran still on the table. It allows Iran to normalize what it's been doing of firing missiles at Israel, firing missiles and drones at other Gulf states as a means of negotiation. And the fact that Israel was not included in any of the negotiations in any apparent way leaves it fairly high and dry.
Would you consider Israel as a co-belligerent? I mean, what was Israel's status in this whole affair? I mean, did they act completely independently, or are they a co-belligerent? Are they an ally? I mean, what is actually their status during this campaign? Can you elaborate on that?
I can't really get into, especially in this forum, the intricacies of how the U.S. and Israel may have worked together operationally, how independent people's actions were, etc.
But how did they view themselves, Jacob? The Israelis, that's where I'm going.
The Israelis viewed themselves very much as an ally in this. I think under a legal status, they were probably closer to a co-belligerent, but Israel certainly viewed itself as an ally, certainly as an independent country that was making its own decisions in coordination with the United States over shared objectives.
So am I right in saying this from an Israeli point of view, is that if they are not invited to the negotiation table, it's a bit of a stretch from their point of view to be included in terms of what the negotiations are going to be about. It's sort of they can't have their cake and they can't eat it. So they are not going to be treated separately, but they are not allowed to make separate military decisions, especially when it comes to Hezbollah and Lebanon. Am I reading that correctly from an Israeli point of view?
From the way the Israelis view this, yes. And I think this is something to remember about the difference between great power. This is not unusual in great power politics. When a great power sits down to negotiate, it historically has often done it on behalf of willing or unwilling partners. When we look at, for instance, some of the Sino-Japanese wars, the ceasefire, the end state of those wars was not negotiated with China or Japan anywhere as part of it, right? It was the British Empire at the time and Russia getting together and deciding kind of how the war would end. This is, unfortunately for smaller countries, this is fairly typical of great powers, how great powers behave, and even more so if you are dependent on the great power for a percentage of your ability to defend yourself, right? The great power then has leverages of control.
Okay, so you've mentioned that, which is an important point, is that Israel most probably is dependent on the United States for a lion's share of the armaments, technology, etc. Is it possible? Is it time for the Israelis? Are they thinking along those lines now of becoming more independent, developing some of their own technology? I mean, is it even possible in the modern world? Let's talk about that, Jacob. Is it possible in the modern world to have an independent armaments industry, such a small little state as Israel, where everything sort of, you know, they're not dependent on anybody? I think those days are long gone. I mean, a lot of the technology and stuff is farmed out all over the world. And I mean, the armaments manufacturers have got factories all over and are dependent on many different players. So I just don't, I wonder what their solution is. Can I even call it cutting the Gordian knot? I don't want to become ideological here, but what are the Israeli options?
So I think before we even get to that part, we do have to remember Israel's not the only country trying to understand the memorandum of understanding, the negotiations, and what's going to happen after. What we're going to see after this is some form of new Middle East emerging in reaction to this, right? Iran had been a potential threat for years. It had been a proxy threat for years, but now it became a real military threat. It struck UAE, it struck Kuwait, it struck Jordan, it struck Saudi, it struck Qatar, right? Everybody and their third cousin, really, and struck in Iraq. And the Middle East is going to have to figure out how to deal with this. Now, one possible way you could see this is a deepening of some relationships like the United Arab Emirates and Israel, that reports have said, you know, there were Israeli forces based in the United Arab Emirates in the war. They were cooperating very closely. So when we think about what a new Middle East might look like, especially if countries decide they might want to pull away from U.S. orbit, then it's not necessarily them each pulling out on their own, right? Or each being simply on their own. There are possibilities for new cooperation, especially in the defense industrial base. And both Saudi and UAE have been looking at creating their own defense industrial base as well. And India and other kind of extra regional players shouldn't be forgotten in this either. That said, when we start to think back to what it would require should Israel want to pull its kind of defense and supply base away from, make itself not so dependent on the U.S. ecosystem, if they choose to go that way, as a lot of Israeli pundits have kind of talked about, it's worth remembering what the cost is.
Yes.
So right now, Israel spends about somewhere between 5 and 7%, let's say, of their GDP directly on defense. The last time Israel had to go without a major U.S. arms deal and supply deal was in the late 1960s. And at that point, Israel was spending about 19.5% of its GDP.
An enormous amount.
Enormous sum.
Yeah.
And in the 1970s, even with the early U.S. arms deals, the rearmament after the 1973 war brought it into the 20%, above 20% range to bring in those modern capabilities, etc. And even then, there were also a lot more socialist-leaning institutions within Israeli civil society to help bear the brunt of some of these costs and help mobilized and reservist families. The defense industry was largely state-owned. Now it's largely privatized, and it was privatized over the last decade. So now it also has to make a profit, which it didn't necessarily previously. So before we even get to the is it a good idea with all of the technology and all of that, any discussion that the Israelis will have on this, or UAE or anybody else, has to first and foremost center on what do you want the state to look like? A lot of the free market economics, a lot of the way we think of Israel today is because they've been able to cut down a lot of their defense spend. And so if it goes back up to 20%, that would radically change a lot of how Israel works and how its defense industry works.
No, certainly. And I mean, there must probably be an intellectual flight with a defense budget of 20%. There's no doubt about that. But you said something very, very interesting, which is something I touched on a couple of weeks ago in one of the war rooms that I had, was the extension of the Abraham Accords. Let's put it that way. Is there a possibility, and you've touched on that, and I think you're alluding to the fact that there may be a possibility. Is there a possibility, is there room for a common front to emerge with Israel as one of the partners as a counterbalance to Iranian power acts independently of the states? Is that something that the Israelis would entertain? Is that something that these other Arab states that are threatened by Iran could entertain? Is there a possibility?
Look, I think the Middle East right now is a little bit in wait-and-see mode, right? There's a lot up in the air with the MOU. There's a lot up in the air with the negotiations. And so, yes, is there a possibility for a deepening cooperation between countries like the Emirates and Israel? Absolutely. They have common interests in more than one place. So for instance, in the Horn of Africa, they both tend to work with Somaliland rather than the Mogadishu government of Somalia, right? They both have this kind of interest in Iran. So there are more than one place where they have overlapping interests. That said, UAE, if we think of Israel as a small country, then UAE is a minuscule country, right? And it has to take into account that it is highly exposed to Iran, its economy is exposed to Iran, and it will be taking these things into account.
Yes.
And so as a result, I think the better way to look at it is right now, the Middle Eastern countries are trying to influence the outcomes of the negotiations, obviously.
Yes.
And they're all a little bit in a wait and see what will happen next. In Lebanon, in the Gulf, in the Strait of Hormuz, there's this moment of kind of frozen activity as everybody's trying to see how the world is going to shape out.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting, Jacob. Is the gorilla in the room? Let's put it this way: stopping Israeli progress to extending the Abraham Accords. The fact that we've got this bleeding sore of the West Bank, it just doesn't seem that there is a possibility of resolving this in the near future. Is it too soon to talk about this type of thing happening on the West Bank? Is that also now on hold? Is any type of Israeli pax, Israel going to be dependent on settling this West Bank issue once and for all? Is it a possibility that this can actually be done in the current environment?
I think, unfortunately, in the current immediate political environment, I don't see a settlement to the West Bank issue. In fact, things have deteriorated significantly in the West Bank in terms of law and order has just been absolutely deteriorating. There's been some pretty outrageous acts of violence by some of the more radical Israeli groups living in the West Bank, twinned with the ever-present threat from Palestinian radical groups. And the situation is just absolutely deteriorating in a rather catastrophic way. But what you can see is that the West Bank continues to create diplomatic and international challenges for any country, honestly, in the Arab world that wants to sign the Abraham Accords, wants to come into the relationship. So when we talk about an extension of the Abraham Accords, I prefer to talk about a deepening of the Abraham Accords.
Okay.
I don't think there's a strong possibility right now for an extension for countries who are not part of the Abraham Accords, because you have Gaza, because you have the West Bank, because you have continued tensions over Lebanon, and because nobody's really sure how the Middle East is going to shake out yet. So there's strategic patience happening, strategic pause in development. What I prefer to talk about is a deepening of the Abraham Accords, that countries like UAE that already have a relationship might deepen that relationship and might find new avenues for cooperation and kind of bind themselves closer to Israel. That I see is more likely than any expansion.
The prize would be Saudi Arabia, surely. That is going to start a cascade if the Saudi Arabians join into this into the Abraham Accords. Is that not the big prize for Israel?
Traditionally, that has been a big prize they've looked for. I'm less sold on the idea of a cascade. I think there tends to be a view of the world that kind of views the Arab world as this monolithic block with these leader countries, and then everybody else follows suit. That's not accurate. Kuwait will have to make its own decisions. Right, Iraq has a law banning any relationships with Israel. When you go to Bahrain, has relations with Israel. Oman is not hostile to Israel, but doesn't have relations to Israel. Each one of these countries, and of course you've got Qatar, has a fairly large challenge.
I mean, that is such an ambiguous situation, Qatar. But anyway, let me not interrupt you.
Yeah. But each of these countries will make its own decision. So even if Saudi were to come over, I wouldn't see that as a guarantee that Kuwait or Qatar or Oman would necessarily follow suit.
Okay, after the break, I want to come back and discuss Syria with you. Let's take a break.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Welcome back to the War Room. I'm David Katz. I'm in discussion with Dr. Jacob Stoyle. Jacob, let's talk a little bit about Syria, because that is an interesting situation. Certainly there are indicators there that from the regime change, the relationship with Israel is certainly, I believe, improved to a certain extent. Not 100% relevant, but showing a tendency towards better relations is the fact that the Syrians are looking to restore some of the synagogues in their capital. I don't know if you've heard about that. So there seems to be a friendlier disposition towards certainly their past Jewish history and maybe towards Israel. Are there any possibilities there with the current Syrian government?
I think there are some good possibilities with the current Syrian government, but I do want to make a couple of caveats. Syria really, really wants to be viewed as a moderate Middle Eastern state by the West. And so restoring synagogues is a very good kind of way to show that, right?
Yes.
It's very easy to be very good to a Jewish population that you don't have.
Some of them may move back, Jacob, if the conditions are become very, 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 very conducive in Syria. Certainly the food is very good in Syria. I've got a little Syrian restaurant up the road from me. The food is very good, I must tell you that. Other than that, I don't know much about Syria, but I'm happy to be illuminated.
It's a beautiful country with very good food. I mean, these are not bad endorsements. so one of the challenges is, of course, the relationship between the Syrian government and its Druze population, and less even the Syrian government, more some of the allies of the Syrian government and the Druze population.
Yes.
Israel entered Syria establishing a buffer zone, both to provide a buffer from the Israeli border, but also to be enable protection of the Druze population in during the Syrian civil war, when the Druze population in Israel, in Syria came under attack. There was tremendous pressure to protect the Druze population in Syria, and Israel didn't do it. Israel provided some, maybe through some covert means, but also provided humanitarian relief, but did not protect the population. And given, especially after October 7th, how clear it should be to the majority of Israelis and to your listeners, how much the Druze population in Israel has contributed to the state, there is a very, very different feeling this time around. So it's unlikely that Israel will immediately withdraw from its positions in Syria. This sets up absolute tension with the Syrian government, who is saying that, well, how can it be a truly sovereign government when you have a foreign army sitting inside its borders, occupying its land? Another issue of contention is that the Syrian government owes a lot of its support and its strength to its allies in Turkey, and Israel and Turkey do not have the best relationship, to say the least. It's quite hostile on a number of fronts. Hamas leadership spends quite a lot of time in Turkey. Hamas has a lot of its infrastructure in Turkey. The Erdogan, the Turkish president, has said really almost bordering on genocidally hostile things to Israel. Israel and Turkey also have rivalries over natural gas fields in the Mediterranean. And with Israel's recognition of Somaliland, increased tensions in the Horn of Africa, as well as Turkey is a major backer of the Mogadishu government and claims natural gas and oil exploration concessions off the coast of Somalia to include Somaliland, which obviously disputes those, and now Israel is backing Somaliland. So the fact that the Syrian government is backed by Turkey will create even more tensions. And then finally, Israel, after October 7th, in a lot of its strategic thinking, has adapted this idea of if there's a question, there is no question, i.e. if an potential adversary has the capability to attack and you don't know whether they intend for sure whether they intend to attack or not, you have to treat them as hostile because you might get the intent wrong and have another October 7th. This line of thinking then leads to a more Israel taking a more bellicose and more kind of militant stance on its forward defense in Syria. So there are possibilities for some kind of better rapprochement. Certainly the situation is much improved from during the civil war or under the Assad regime. And there are signs there are signs that in the fullness of time it can continue to improve, but we shouldn't kid ourselves that this is going to be easy or a direct line. And I'll throw in with all of the other relationships as well, that the MOU matters, the negotiations with Iran matter, because the way the Middle East looks, should Iran become a resurgent power, should Iran become one of the dominant powers in the Middle East, will be quite different from how it looks if Iran is a more humbled power or Iran is less aggressive. And so all of this, really, everything we're talking about, whether it's the West Bank, whether it's Syria, whether it's Lebanon, whether it's UAE or Saudi, or if we want to look further afield to India and Pakistan and on this entire region, depends very heavily now on what are going to be the outcomes of these negotiations.
And I'm sure, Jacob, you've touched on it, but I'm sure one of those parties waiting with bated breath to see the outcome of all this is Turkey, because certainly Turkey would have been a factor to consider in the wake of a diminished Iran. They would have been able to fill a lot of the void left behind by Iran. Now, if you're talking about a resurgent Iran, which is a possibility under the MOU, it certainly affects the Turkish. What is their role and what is their standing in this whole thing? And am I reading it correctly that they are part of the balance of power against the Iranians?
I think thinking about it as a balance of power leads us into sort of a binary view that you've got a balance of power against the Iranians and a balance of the power for the Iranians. In the current Middle East, and most likely, I think, going forward, what you're really seeing is a multi polar Middle East, where you have Turkey working to expand its power and its footprint, which will mean potentially working with Iran on some things and potentially working against them on others. You'll have Israel trying to secure itself, and you'll have Saudi and UAE trying to navigate the waters and figure out how to secure their own power. And again, we have to think a little bit broader. So Saudi and Pakistan have entered a new relationship where Pakistani forces are deployed in defense of Saudi Arabia. So we now have actual Pakistani military in the Middle East. We have Turkey, Saudi, and Egypt all in discussions. We have UAE and Israel in discussions. Yes. So there's the possibility, and we have India kind of in discussions with UAE and Israel, but also heavily dependent on Iran.
Yes.
And so I think the way to understand this is not that there are two blocks, but one of the things that may emerge from the Iran conflict and the Iran negotiations is that you have a series of regional powers,
yes,
each trying to secure their own interests and power, and then you have smaller states who are having to make decisions about how to navigate among them. And Turkey is definitely one of those regional powers in Syria, in Iraq, and of course, as a maritime power in the Mediterranean as well.
Yes, no, absolutely. And you're talking about Pakistan. I mean, it's messy, Jacob, to say the least. And you're 100% right. We can't think about it in binary terms. Pakistan has a relationship, as you say, now with Saudi Arabia, but it certainly has a relationship with Iran. I think there's also some type of a pact there. When we come back from the break, I want to discuss that. And then also I want to discuss the Kurdish issue. Let's take that break.
Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
You're listening to The War Room. My name's David Katz. I'm in conversation with Dr. Jacob Stoyle. I was wanting to discuss with you, Jacob, about the Kurdish situation. Let me just talk about, I was talking about Pakistan also. Let me just speak about Pakistan quickly. So Pakistan has got a finger in a couple of pies. It seems to be playing a major, major role in these negotiations, certainly for facilitating them. So that increases their viability, certainly in the region. But they also, as you say, they've got a relationship with Saudi Arabia. They have a relationship with Iran. They're an interesting new, well, let's not say new player, but they're an interesting player in the mix.
Absolutely. And their relationship with Iran is a very complicated one. They have a lot of cooperation. On the other hand, in 2024, they exchanged strikes back and forth with Iran. Iran has an insurgency in its Baluchistan province, which borders Pakistan. And so their relationship is very, very mixed. They have some mutual dependencies. They have areas of cooperation, but they also have fired on each other within the last 2 years. So they're very kind of sit in this space where they're part of the Middle East in some respects and not part in other respects. They look towards Afghanistan, where they have a lot of challenges on their border with Afghanistan that have also resulted in violence. Obviously, they have their relationship with India, and of course, looking east, they have China. And so they sit both in the Middle East picture and outside of it. Mm. And that has given them the ability, because of their relationship with Iran and their relationship with the United States, to play a mediating role and to be part of these negotiations. It has, their relationship with Saudi Arabia has allowed them to deploy forces there. And so they are, I think, in the process of thinking about and taking steps to be kind of higher prestige in the region and be more of a player. Indonesia, by the way, for what it's worth, is doing a similar thing with volunteering to be the main component for the International Stabilization Force in Gaza, putting troops there, part of that. And so there's this, as I kind of keep repeating, I think, and I sound a little bit like a broken record, so I apologize to your listeners, that there is this moment of change we're going through in the Middle East right now. The Middle East is in a state of flux brought on, really, it started with October 7th. It started with Hamas's October 7th attacks, and it has continued and is now reaching a sort of concentration point, of flux, the flux, the chaos, the uncertainty around these Iran negotiations is really setting the strategic stage for what comes next. And until that picture becomes clear, there is a room for a lot of potential futures and a lot of involvement of actors who we might not be used to thinking about as a major player.
Yes, absolutely. And one of them being the Kurds, which could be a double-edged sword, but maybe a natural ally for the Israelis, excepting for that their footprint spreads to many, many countries, and certainly the Turkish would feel threatened, the Syrians. I mean, everybody in that area, the Iraqis, whoever contains a Turkish, a Kurdish population is not going to be happy with an Israeli relationship with the Kurds. But that is certainly a possibility for the Israelis, certainly when it comes to combating some of the Iranian influence. How do you feel about that?
There is a history of relationships between Israelis and the Kurds at various times, not always the smoothest, but they do have a history of relations. And of course, if you are to travel around northern Israel and lots of other places in Israel, you're going to see a large Kurdish Jewish population. Northern Israel along the Lebanon border, I always think of because it's an area where Iran is also attacking, right, through Hezbollah. So Iran launched ground offensives against the Kurds recently into Iraq and raids into Iraq, and also was attacking Kurdish Jews on the northern border. Now, I'm sure Iran doesn't conceive of it that way. I do think, however, it is just an interesting point of overlap. The Kurds do offer some possibilities for Israel, and certainly have been looked at in the past. There are distinct challenges that you correctly identified, which is that the Kurds don't have a country of their own. They exist in Iraq, they exist in Turkey, they exist in Syria, and they exist in Iran. And they have worked with a lot of powers. They've worked very closely with the US. Before that, they've worked with the British. They've worked with Iraq. They've worked with Iran at various times, when it was Persia. And really trying to get their own state created, and nobody wants to do it. In Iraq, they sit near some of the most oil-rich and water-rich regions of Iraq, so nobody wants to kind of carve that off and say, okay, that'll be a different state, certainly not the Iraqi government.
Sure.
Iran is committed to suppressing them. Turkey is committed to suppressing them. And without U.S. support, the Syrian government was able to launch a military offensive into the Kurdish-controlled areas of Syria, largely disarming them. And so, unfortunately, and I say unfortunately because I do, to an extent, believe in, you know, democratic self-determination if a population really wants its own country, right? The same basis that a lot of countries exist on. The Kurds are in a very weak spot right now. Without U.S. support, without significant Israeli support, and with all of the countries in the region kind of turned against them, it does put them in a weak spot. This is not to say there are not possibilities, and there are certainly possibilities. And I'm sure some very smart people in Israel may be exploring this.
No, absolutely. I don't know whether we got time to explore my last one, which was India, which I think could be a very big and significant natural ally for the Israelis. Certainly, the relationship seems to be improving on a yearly basis. I don't know if you ever bumped into a General Jack Jacob of the Israeli of the Indian Army, who is Chief of Staff. Interesting Jewish gentleman who fought in the who was a member of the Indian Army, and he was instrumental in improving the, I think it was Governor of Goa also, he was instrumental in improving the relations between India and Israel that were not always good. Jacob, a quick line on the Indians, and I think we're going to wrap it up after that.
So, very quickly, I like you bringing General Jacob in to the conversation. I think a lot of listeners are unaware of the deep, deep historical Indian Jewish communities, both in South and Cochin, and also the Baghdadi community and several of the other communities that have existed, that had existed there for hundreds of years. India has the possibility of a close relationship with Israel. It certainly cooperates with UAE. It's certainly shown that it's willing to have a closer relationship with Israel. It is, however, worth noting that they still get quite a lot of oil and resources from Iran. And so there may be some challenges at a point in that relationship. But returning to a theme, a lot of this will depend on what ends up happening with the negotiations. And this is really why your listeners should understand, as they're looking to understand the Middle East, everybody's holding their breath. In the Middle East, in the world, we haven't even touched on the global implications of Iranian control of the Strait of Hormuz, which hopefully will not be an issue that we have to discuss, but maybe next month when we have a conversation again, we can discuss it if it's still an issue. There are absolutely global implications. So really, everyone in the region, everyone in the globe is holding their breath and hoping for the best outcome of these negotiations, because the Middle East stands at a precipice and nobody knows what's on the other side of it.
Thank you, Dr. Jacob Stoyle, for those wonderful ending words. I'm going to leave it at that. Thank you for illuminating the situation. Your message is not exactly comforting. In certain areas, it's a bit bleak. And yes, I take your point that we need over the next weeks or months to see what the result of this memorandum of understanding is going to bring to all of us. I wish everybody a good evening.